Blog Talk Radio.
That was the amazing and indelible James Taylor singing Some Children See Him, one of my favorite Christmas songs. And it is Christmas in August, and this is our Remembrance Birthday Brunch with Jesus, our Master. who was born on August the 21st. I like to call it your ranch and high holy days, and I welcome all of you to our show today to celebrate with us and have a little brunch. Hope you grabbed your cup of coffee or your cup of tea and a piece of toast with marmalade, pancakes, or just some raw fruits and veggies. And you're ready to have a remembrance with us and give us a call and tell us what your favorite remembrance of Jesus and the life he lived amongst us. And with me, of course, is my very dear friend and co-host, Krystalyn Beek Larson. Hi, Krystalyn.
Good morning. How are you today?
Good morning. Yes, I am great. And, you know, sadly, our dear friend Andre, who really wanted to be with us on this show, had to work today. We're bummed out about that because he's working hard today, and we know how much he wanted to be with us at this Remembrance Birthday Brunch. In fact, it was his idea. So, Andre, we will drink a cup of cheer for you and hope you get to listen to the show later. Who knows, maybe he'll get a minute to call in. That would be nice. Our call-in number is 646-716-8158. And what Andre did for us is he came up with three questions that in remembrance of Jesus, and maybe you just want to share your favorite vignette from the life and teachings of Jesus. But the first question is, what teaching of Jesus most speaks to your soul? The second one, what vignette of Joshua ben Joseph's life is most vivid for you? And, of course, the third one, what if you were alone with the Master? What would you most want to ask him today? Or even most want to tell him? You know, Jesus was a great listener, wasn't he? And that's something that I cherish myself very much because I get to talk to a lot of people. I should say confer with, because I listen a lot, and I often remember that that Jesus' greatest service was just to listen to somebody and let them unburden their soul. And I think that's what really, to me, that's what ministry is about. So I cherish that. I talk to Jesus a lot every day, and I unburden my soul, and I know in my heart of hearts that he's listening.
That
so
is
what
a very comforting, very comforting thought that he is always listening.
He's always
here for us.
Yeah. And I love that song, too, especially because I think that Jesus' ministry to every human being is personal. He is personally there for you and has a relationship with you and me and everybody. And so how we see him in our heart of hearts, how we hear him, it's a personal matter. And we're all God's children, and we all see him in the divine pattern that we hold in our hearts. And so that's why I love that song. It's actually one of my very favorites, and I could listen to it all year long. And it's Christmas in August, and you know, maybe we can explain a little bit for anybody who happens to be listening who doesn't know why we celebrate Jesus' birthday in August. Krystalyn, you want to take a stab at that?
Well, the Urantia book tells us that he was born on August 21st, about noon. And there's a wonderful story of the birth of Jesus and what Mary and Joseph went through in Bethlehem. And how Mary talked Joseph into taking her along with him because she was afraid that Jesus would be born with Joseph being gone.
Right.
So she went on this road trip, basically, just a day before Jesus was born. And found an actually very nice, cleaned out stable that had been made ready for guests. So it was actually a very nice lodgings compared to where some of the people had to stay. Not quite as humble as maybe we, some of us might imagine.
And the Urantia book says they considered themselves quite fortunate to get that accommodation. So, you know, it's quite a stretch for us in this day and age when we could jump in the car and drive down to the beautiful birthing rooms at the local hospital if we were in labor. But here they were in a city that was overflowing with pilgrims who were coming for the census. And they had just made a long journey, and I can't even imagine myself, Mary being 9 months pregnant on the back of a mule. That's inconceivable to me, frankly. I mean, no wonder Jesus was born when he was, because, you know, any woman that's that pregnant knows that something like that is bound to bring labor on pretty intensely. So, you know, that was probably expected, and maybe she had a feeling. You know, I think my mom always said that. She said, you'll know when the baby's going to come. You know, it's just, you get this feeling, and I'm sure that her anxiety before, with Joseph leaving, she just knew the baby was going to come while he was gone, and she didn't want that to happen. So she made that long, arduous journey with him on the back of a mule, and when she got there, she delivered, and the story is that the innkeeper had cleaned out his stables. They were carved into the side of the mountain, right? They were like,
mm-hmm.
like caves or something, and he had filled them with clean straw and hung up curtains, and they actually felt themselves quite lucky to have such clean and comfortable accommodations.
And it says the inn was overcrowded, and Joseph accordingly sought lodgings with distant relatives. But every room in Bethlehem was filled to overflowing. On returning to the courtyard of the inn, he was informed that the caravan stables hewn out of the side of the rock and situated just below the inn had been cleared of animals and cleaned up for the reception of lodgers. Leaving the donkey in the courtyard, Joseph shouldered their bags of clothing and provisions, and with Mary descended the stone steps into their lodgings below. They found themselves located in what had been a grain storage room to the front of the stalls and mangers. Tent curtains had been hung, and they counted themselves fortunate to have such comfortable quarters. Joseph had thought to go out at once and enroll, but Mary was weary. She was considerably distressed and besought him to remain by her side, which he did. Then it says that all that night, Mary was restless, so that neither of them slept much. By the break of day, the pangs of childhood were well in evidence, and at noon, August 21st, 7 B.C., with the help and kind ministrations of women fellow travelers, Mary was delivered of a male child. Jesus of Nazareth was born into the world, was wrapped in the clothes which Mary had brought along for such a possible contingency, and laid in a nearby manger.
And the fact that it was a grain storage room makes it perfectly clear then that why there would be a nearby manger, and what a perfect little cradle that would make for him. And, you know, just thinking about being a new mom at one time myself, what it was like to be in labor for the first time, not knowing what to expect, and having been in labor with a new dad who didn't know what to expect. And then my heart goes out to her to think that she was so far away from home, and from her mother, maybe, and her sisters, or, you know, her closest associates who would have helped her. And so she had to rely on the kindness of strangers, who, of course, rose to the occasion.
It also goes on to say that at the noontide birth of Jesus, the seraphim of Urantia, assembled under their directors, did sing anthems of glory over the Bethlehem manger. But these utterances of praise were not heard by human ears. No shepherds nor any other mortal creatures came to pay homage to the babe of Bethlehem until the day of the arrival of certain priests from Ur, who were sent down from Jerusalem by Zacharias. These priests from Mesopotamia had been told some time before by a strange religious teacher of their country that he had had a dream in which he was informed that the light of life was about to appear on earth as a babe and among the Jews. And thither went these three teachers looking for this light of life. After many weeks of futile search in Jerusalem, they were about to return to Ur when Zacharias met them and disclosed his belief that Jesus was the object of their quest and sent them on to Bethlehem, where they found the babe and left their gifts with Mary, his earth mother. The babe was almost 3 weeks old at the time of their visit. These wise men saw no star to guide them to Bethlehem. The beautiful legend of the Star of Bethlehem originated in this way. Jesus was born August 21st at noon, 7 BC. On May 29th, 7 BC, there occurred an extraordinary conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn in the constellation of Pisces, and it is a remarkable astronomic fact that similar conjunctions occurred on September 29th and December 5th of the same year. Wow. Upon the basis of these extraordinary but wholly natural events, the well-meaning zealots of the succeeding generation constructed the appealing legend of the Star of Bethlehem and the adoring magi led thereby to the manger, where they beheld and worshipped a newborn babe. Oriental and near-Oriental minds delight in fairy stories, and they are continually spinning such beautiful myths about the lives of their religious leaders and political heroes. In the absence of printing, when most human knowledge was passed by word of mouth from one generation to another, it was very easy for myths to become traditions and for traditions eventually become accepted as facts.
Isn't that amazing to think about how, you know, humanity reacts to such an event?
Indeed.
And it's almost like we all know, even though we don't know, we do. We know that something special happened. And the way that we, you know, the conclusions we draw, one of the things that I'm looking forward to asking my angels when I get a chance to sit down and have a real conversation with them, is what were the things that I thought you did that you didn't actually do, and what were the things that you actually did that I had no clue that you did? You know? It's kind of like that. You know, we interpret from our mystical state, from our half-dream state, celestial events, and we add meaning to them that really are, that really don't deserve meaning, and then we totally miss other events that happen that were actually them working diligently in our lives, and we were clueless, clueless to what they did. So here we are on the eve of Jesus' birthday, August the 21st, at high noon, and lots of you Rancho Book readers all over the country and all over the world will be meeting this weekend and next weekend to celebrate together, and many will meet actually right on the 21st. I know the folks in Oklahoma, the readers in Oklahoma have a tradition that they love to meet right on the 21st, and they always plan a banquet at a beautiful hotel and get all dressed up. And it's cool. Every group has their own tradition. Every Urantia Book Reading group has their own tradition, and it's one of the things that is so endearing to me about all of us. And I understand that you know, Bro Dave is saying on the board also at 533 headquarters in Chicago. Of course, they would have a celebration for Jesus' birthday. You know, your Rancher Book readers feel blessed because we actually get to celebrate it twice. We get to celebrate it when the rest of the world celebrates his birth at Christmas. And most readers understand that Christmas is actually the birth of Mithras and the winter, what is it, the winter solstice, December
yeah.
the 25th?
Well, it isn't the winter solstice as we know it, but it was when they celebrated that
right.
for many eons.
And we know that the great religious negotiator and compromiser, Paul, negotiated with some of the Mithraic religions existent in the day and made that compromise to celebrate Jesus' birthday. Well, the first time I ever heard that was from the Jehovah's Witnesses, believe it or not. They believe and they hold, according to, biblical knowledge and their biblical scholars and their theologians, the Jehovah's Witness theologians say that the 25th of December is really a pagan holiday. And so they don't celebrate it for that reason. And those of us who have read the life and teachings of Jesus in the Urantia book probably know that God is not opposed to his children celebrating the reality of his existence at any time, any day, every day. And this is first, or the December the 25th is as good as any day. August the 21st is the day that we're given in the Urantia book. And so the beautiful thing about that is, for Urantia book readers, is we get to go and be with each other at the end of summer. Harvest is coming on. But many of us go to some outdoor venue. I know in Colorado we love to meet at a park. We pack a picnic lunch and we have a pinata for the kids and a birthday cake for Jesus. Happy birthday, Michael of Nebadon, or happy birthday, Jesus, or whatever.
Or Joshua Ben-Joseph.
Or Joshua Ben-Joseph, and sometimes we have three concentric circles on it, and it's always delicious, and it's always, you know, and then we share a feast together, and we play in the park, and we may play volleyball or baseball or horseshoes. This is what we've done in our area for years and years and years. And it's always a celebration, and it's always deep and rich and meaningful. And so we cherish that because it's one day where, you know, that in as much as Christmas has become commercial, and people lament that, we have the 21st of August, and we can really celebrate the birth of our Savior. The birth of our planetary prince, our rightful planetary prince, the birth of our sovereign on his seventh bestowal. Wow.
Anyway, we invite you all to call in and share with us your personal experiences about what the life of Jesus has meant to you personally at 646-716-8158. That number again is 646-716-8158. Please give us a call and join us live on Cosmic Citizen as we enjoy a remembrance brunch with the Master.
And pick your favorite vignette, you know, from the life and teachings of Jesus, or even from your own personal experiences with the Master. And maybe you had a personal experience in your life where you were speaking to him, praying to him, and he gave you a word of comfort, or you were led to something about him that was touching and amazing to you. That's fine too. Andre gave us three questions to think about. What teaching of Jesus most speaks to your soul? What vignette of Joshua Ben-Joseph's life is most vivid for you? What if you were alone with the Master? What would you ask him today? And, you know, maybe you would just want to be in his presence. And that would be touching and endearing as well, obviously. And, you know, I chose something from God Calling because many of you may have heard of it. I don't know. But it's something that came through at the exact same time that the Urantia book came through, in about 1933. Two English women went apart with Jesus every day and prayed for wisdom and guidance. And Jesus spoke, and the one woman would speak the word and the other woman would write it down. And the two women, ironically, just like the sleeping subject of the Urantia book, remained completely anonymous. They didn't want to be known for this particular work known as God Calling. But they shared it with the world, and I'm glad they did. It's 365 daily lessons from Jesus, and they simply, the two women called themselves two listeners. And this one is from January 19th. It's called Love Anticipates. They say, Lord, I will seek thee, and he answers. The anticipatory love of God is a thing mortals seldom realize. Dismiss the thought of a grudging God. None ever sought me in vain. I wait, wait with a hungry longing to be called upon. And I, who have already seen your hearts, needs, before you cried upon me, before perhaps you were conscious of those needs yourself, I am ready, preparing the answer. It is like a mother who is setting aside suitable gifts for her daughter's wedding. Before love even has come into the daughter's life, the anticipatory love of God is a thing mortals seldom realize. Dwell on this thought. Dismiss from your minds the thought of a grudging God who had to be petitioned with sighs and tears and much speaking before reluctantly he loosed the desired treasures. Man's thoughts of me need revolutionizing. Try and see a mother preparing birthday or Christmas delights for her child. The while her mother heart sings, will she not love that? How she will love this! And anticipates the rapture of her child, her own heart full of tenderest joy. Where did the mother learn all this preparation joy? From me. A faint echo of this, my preparation joy. Try to see this as plans unfold of my preparing. It means much to me to be understood, and the understanding of me will bring great joy to you. I love God Calling because when I read it, it brings me into his presence.
It does feel very much like a similar experience that we have in reading some of the vignettes of his life from the Urantia book.
So pick a favorite, Crystalline.
Well, I really have been moved by the time that he spent traveling around the Roman Empire and the Middle East. Before his public ministry, and the time when he stopped at the side of the Caspian in a small town, I think. I'm not sure actually how large of a town it was then, but a place called Urmia.
Mm.
And in Urmia there was a school of religion that had been founded by a man by the name of Symbioton. And all of the great religions of the world were allowed to give lectures and discussions at this school about their ideas about religion. And there was one rule was that this, by the way, was a lecture amphitheater dedicated to the spirit of religion. This structure was really a temple of the philosophy of religions. This temple of religion had been built by a wealthy merchant citizen of Urmia and his three sons. And they would lecture about their ideas about religion, and there were two requirements. One was that they all believed in a central deity, some form of deity. And secondly, that they were not allowed to lord their concepts of religion over anyone else. And Jesus had passed by before, and Symbioten had arranged with Jesus to sojourn with them for 2 weeks on his return trip and give 24 lectures on, quote, the brotherhood of men, to conduct 12 evening sessions of questions, discussions, and debates on his lectures, in particular on the brotherhood of man in general. And so that's one of my favorite things to imagine about his life before he became a public person or recognized for his great teaching. And he talks about sovereignty, divine and human. The brotherhood of man is founded on the fatherhood of God. The family of God is derived from the love of God. God is love. God the Father divinely loves his children, all of them. The kingdom of heaven, the divine government, is founded on the fact of divine sovereignty. God is spirit. Since God is spirit, his kingdom is spiritual. The kingdom of heaven is neither material nor merely intellectual. It is a spiritual relationship between God and man. If different religions recognize the spirit sovereignty of God the Father, then will all such religions remain at peace. Only when one religion assumes that it is in some way superior to all others and that it possesses exclusive authority over other religions, will such a religion presume to be intolerant of other religions or dare to persecute other religious believers? Religious peace, brotherhood, can never exist until all religions are willing to completely divest themselves of all ecclesiastical authority and fully surrender all concept of spiritual sovereignty. God alone is spirit sovereign. You cannot have equality among religions, religious liberty, without having religious wars, unless all religions consent to the transfer of all religious sovereignty to some superhuman level, to God himself. The kingdom of heaven in the hearts of men will create religious unity, not necessarily uniformity, because any and all religious groups composed of such religious believers will be free from all notions of ecclesiastical authority, religious sovereignty. There's quite a bit more that goes on in his lectures, but I'd like to just read two more short paragraphs.
Sure.
The moment you lose sight of the spirit sovereignty of God the Father, some one religion will begin to assert its superiority over other religions, and then instead of peace on earth and goodwill among men, there will start dissensions, recriminations, even religious wars, at least wars among religionists. Free will beings who regard themselves as equals, unless they mutually acknowledge themselves as subject to some super sovereignty, some authority over and above themselves, sooner or later are tempted to try out their ability to gain power and authority over other persons and groups. The concept of equality never brings peace except in the mutual recognition of some over-controlling influence of super-sovereignty. Isn't it interesting that at Christmas time we come together as Christians anyway and talk about the Prince of Peace, about Jesus coming to bring peace on earth and goodwill among men. And yet we hardly practice that level of religious unity, that true kingdom of heaven in the hearts of men, creating that spiritual unity, not necessarily uniformity. And we, Paula and I, have experienced within the interfaith movement some of that that sense of spiritual unity, of people coming together from many different religions and really reveling in a spirit of unity and not uniformity, gathering together to discuss philosophy and to share our beliefs in a peaceful, orderly, loving manner from all over the world. It's quite a beautiful experience. And I believe that is the beginning of an experience of that peace on earth.
This notion of the surrender of sovereignty, oh, it's just so amazing and so powerful. And you know, I've come to believe that it's not just about surrendering religious sovereignty. It's about surrendering political sovereignty, surrendering natural national sovereignty, and also personal, right? Personal
giving
sovereignty.
Our will over to God.
Well, yeah, not only that, but giving over all notions that you're any better than any other human being on earth. Every human on the planet has strengths and weaknesses. No human here is perfect. No human here is worthy to lord it over every other being or any other being. You know, the idea of dictatorships and despots who bend, you know, other human beings to their own will, and you know, the Arantia book tells us that the legacy of the rebellion that our planet is in is unmitigated selfishness and unbridled self-liberty. So this idea that one person or one group of persons should control everything, the outworking of everything, and that there is no sovereign power above them, is just ludicrous. And there is no humility in that idea. You know, it even gives us in that same section of the book you're talking about, Crystalline, that you just read from, he also gives a talk on sovereignty.
Political sovereignty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the Midwayers give us this wonderful commentary about what makes the United States so wonderful. And it's interesting, what makes us wonderful, what makes us amazing in the history of the world is the fact that 50 independent states have surrendered their sovereignty over to a federal government, a sovereign government, that they agreed they would make that government sovereign. And they surrender certain rights over to that government. And that is how those 50 states can exist in peace. That's why they can. And it's interesting to me, anyway, that the one thing that allows us to exist in peace is often the one thing that we attack and rail against. And, yeah, of course, we need to create checks and balances of power, but you know, it goes on from there to say that we could surrender the world, all of the nations of the world could surrender sovereignty over to a world government, and that would be really the beginning of peace on earth, because then we would, you know, obviously the next step would be for that world government to understand that there is one sovereign, and that sovereign is God. And Jesus himself said, you know, regardless of the blunders of your fellow men and their world management of today, the words I speak to you will one day rule this very world. The words
Isn't that
I
beautiful?
Speak, I know. And that's a promise. That's a promise. And we have a caller. So let's take our first caller, Crystal.
All right.
Area code 603, you're with us on the Cosmic Citizen, a Remembrance Birthday Brunch with Jesus.
Hey, Paul and Crystal, this is Lou from New Hampshire.
Hey, Lou.
Good morning, Lou.
Hi.
Merry Christmas.
Thank you. There's a regional birthday celebration in a state park in Massachusetts that I try to go to every year. That was canceled because of rain today, and the rain date is tomorrow, and the weather's looking better tomorrow. So
oh,
I hope to go down then. And I want to echo your earlier comments. I'm missing Andre today, too. This is no reflection on the two great hosts we have, but he brings so much. He brings so much to the table, and he was a great choice as a co-anchor there.
Well, we love him.
Just quite a mandate, didn't he, with these three little birthday challenges almost. I want to speak to one of them.
Okay.
And that's the vignettes. I really gave that some thought. And I couldn't possibly come up with one, but I have a list of seven here, if I may.
Sure.
I'll try to present them in chronological order. They all have to do with his adult life, although there are several great vignettes that he did as a child. And the big one probably being stepping up to the plate and becoming a father, brother to this huge family, you know. And that was probably one of the most heroic things any young man has ever been called upon to do. But in roughly chronological order, I think the boy who was afraid, Fortune was his name.
Isn't that almost everybody's favorite?
Everybody knows that one for sure. I think what I most enjoy about this story is the gentle way with which Jesus drew the boy out by asking direction. Mm. Because I've been that boy. I've been alone on the hill and wanted to just be alone with my misery and didn't want to talk to anybody. And I just think the gentle way that Jesus drew him out was the best part of that story. And the advice he gave him was like a great pep talk, you know. Get out there and face the world like a man. Pep talk was great, but getting to the point where he could talk to him was a great part of that story.
Yes,
indeed.
Opening him up to where he was willing to hear what Jesus had to say, more than willing to hear it.
Yeah, and that was the brilliance of Jesus as a teacher. He looked into your heart, saw the depth of your faith, and wasn't going to lose you by over-teaching you. He attenuated his message to the level of his listener, and that's why he was so effective, especially on this individual one-on-one basis. Now, later he resorted to parables to reach audiences at all different levels, and that was also very effective. The next story is on the same trip, and I think when he's with the boy Ganeed, and they run into two courtesans, and Ganeed takes this immediate self-righteous attitude of judgment toward the girls, and Jesus just steps in and disarms the whole situation with love. And he says, look into these eyes. These girls are more victims than victimizers. They've been sinned against more than they've ever sinned. And just the way he turned that around, that was just another one of those great instances of personal ministry where the message was just so applicable to so many things that we run into in all our lives. And then he knocks on Martha's door, Justice's wife, in the middle of the night, and he says, "We're hungry," you know. and she rose to the occasion, you know. That's a wonderful story. The next one, shortly before this very incident, Jesus finds a man who's publicly misusing his wife, and he taps him on the shoulder and draws him aside. It's kind of a private word with you, and the very gentle way in which he disarmed that situation. Again, very personal one-on-one sorts of ministry. I'm seeing a theme here in my own vignettes. And I was very touched with that story. He didn't come slamming down on the guy. He didn't say, hey, what the heck are you doing here? It was just the gentle way in which he got the guy to open up. He says, she's really a good woman. She just picks on me in public. Well, hell, every husband on the planet can understand that one. He gets picked on in public.
She nagged me, in other words.
Yeah. What's the big deal? Everybody gets this, you know?
Yeah.
The next one, which is different, because these are all like personal one-on-one ministries, but the next one on my list is the cleansing of the temple. This is such a strong and proactive, aggressive example of righteous indignation. And that you know, the gospel sort of has this story mixed up. Jesus only loosed the animals. That's all he did. But it was the crowd that overturned the money changer's table. They got involved in it, too. That was just his righteous indignation is the only way to describe that one. And I just thought it's a great story of how strong and aggressive and manly this man can be. In addition to all his meekness and forbearance, he knew how to throw a punch when he had to. And I thought that was way cool. One of my favorite stories.
Oh my gosh.
Isn't that a good one? The next one is washing the apostles' feet. We have these guys upstairs fighting over places of table, discussing positions of honor, and the creator of the universe walks in, takes off his tunic, wraps himself in a towel, and gets on his knees with a basin and washes their feet. I can't believe this. This has got to be one of the all-time visual lessons. No words were necessary here. You know, the greatest among you would be the servant of all. This is an incredible visual.
What an illustration.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. And, you know, you make me think of his last temple discourse, which I think the first time I read that, my heart just about came right out of my chest. It's like because he was speaking to what I was so opposed to in my own life, and that was ecclesiastical authorities who entrenched themselves behind ecclesiastical power and enslaved people religiously so that they feel afraid of God. And they, you know, and I mean, to me, just the injustice of it is just unbelievable, that my own sense of indignation about it. And by the time as a 20-year-old that I got to that last temple discourse where he started saying, woe upon you,
yeah,
I was like, yes, yes, tears of joy.
The amazing thing about that section, Paula, is the way it builds. He starts out holding out his hand, offering conciliation and forgiveness and mercy and
right.
Just come on board. Just get on the bus, guys. Just get on the bus. I'll get you to where you're headed. And then it builds to all this indignation and you vipers. You know, it's like, whoa, that was an amazing discourse. Absolutely amazing.
Oh, my gosh. You know, I just want to share a couple of the words from that, a couple of the woe upon yous, because they're just so powerful, so poignant. He says, woe upon you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. You would shut the doors of the kingdom of heaven against sincere men because they happen to be unlearned in the ways of your teaching. You refuse to enter the kingdom and at the same time do everything within your power to prevent all others from entering. You stand with your backs to the doors of salvation and fight with all who would enter therein. Woe upon you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites that you are! For you indeed encompass land and sea to make one proselyte, and when you have succeeded, you are not content until you have made him twofold worse than he was as a child of the heathen. Woe upon you, chief priests and rulers, who lay hold of the property of the poor and demand heavy dues of those who would serve God as they think Moses ordained. You who refuse to show mercy, can you hope for mercy in the worlds to come? I mean, he just goes on to say, you know, you're so careful to clean the outside of the cup when the inside is full of filth. And if you would clean the inside, the contents would just naturally spill over and clean the outside. You know, I mean, it's irrefutable logic. And then he goes on, it's so beautiful.
So well, with such passion. Probably very much the way Jesus delivered it. What's kind of funny here is, if you listen to Merritt Horn read it, and I love the Merritt Horn audio tapes, I listen to them all the time. If you listen to Merritt Horn read it, he's got his usual kind of monotone drone here. Well, you know Jesus is really yelling at this crowd, you know. And it's kind of a funny thing to listen to, because his reading doesn't embrace it as you just did, as definitely as you just did.
Oh, yeah. To me, I hear, you know, in my heart of hearts, it's like he's finally going to tell them, you know, this is what you're doing, you know, and it's like one last attempt to get them to hear him, to listen, you know, because they're making some serious mistakes. It's like a parent who's trying to get his child attention, you know. You can't go down that way anymore. Don't go down there. But
I have
course,
just two more vignettes I'd like to
Okay.
share. And one is the thief on the cross.
Oh.
This is a story that just, I just fall on the floor in tears. I can't get through the story. In fact, once I made a presentation at a regional gathering here in New England, and this was part of it. And I asked Meredith Tenney to read it for me, because I knew I could never get through this story. This is, he fanned the flickering flame of his face. The midwayers, they're so good with alliteration.
Amazing.
That needs no further comment. The story says there's one where Jesus tells the joke of a millennium, and I'm not sure how many people get this. I'm going to read this to you. It's from paper 199. I think it's a scream, and I got it immediately the first time I read it. It says, shortly after 9 o'clock that evening, after the departure of Cleopas and Jacob, while the Alpheus twins comforted Peter, and while Nathanael remonstrated with Andrew, and as the 10 were there assembled in the upper chamber with the doors all bolted for fear of arrest, the master in Marantia form suddenly appeared in the midst of them, saying, peace be upon you. Why are you so frightened when I appear, as though you had seen a spirit? And if he said it, you look like, if he said it, you know, you guys look like you'd seen a ghost.
Yeah.
And he's gotten it, you know. This is post-resurrection humor. He says, you look like you've seen a ghost. And that's the end of my vignette. It's really hard. How do you pick out one episode in a life this magnificent?
Oh,
I couldn't. You just can't. And I could probably think of 1,000 more, but that's, if you've got another caller, let someone else have a chance here.
Well, you know, we don't yet, but it's a great segue to say our call-in number, friends. And if you have some, like what Lewis shared, and this is what we're hoping that you'll share with us, it's 646-716-8158. And Lou, you just reminded me of something that it's funny how you're reading the Jesus papers, and sometimes, you know, to me it's just humorous, the situation Jesus is in, and you kind of got to chuckle. And one of my favorites like that is as they were, you know, with the crowd. And I keep in my mind the image of Jesus Christ Superstar, you know. Here he's coming into town, and all of the apostles are around him. They're like his entourage. And the crowd is just thronging them, right? They're trying to get close to the master. And the apostles are doing their best. It's kind of like a superstar, rock star, who has his entourage, and they're trying to keep the crowd, you know, back a little bit, because they're pressing in on the master. And this was kind of at the height of his, you know, popularity. And so here's the vignette. As Jesus went along with Jairus, the large crowd, which had heard of the father's request, followed on to see what would happen. Shortly before they reached the ruler's house, as they hastened through the narrow street, and as the throng jostled him, Jesus suddenly stopped, exclaiming, someone touched me. Now, I find this humorous, because I can imagine, here's Peter nearby. It goes on to say, when those who were near him denied that they had touched him, Peter spoke up, Master, you can see that this crowd presses you, threatening to crush us, and yet you say, someone has touched me.
what do you mean? I love this. I find it humorous because, you know, you just get the scene in your mind. Here's all these people pressing up against them. And, of course, someone, Master, of course someone touched you. As Jesus looked upon him, his eyes fell upon a nearby woman who, coming forward, knelt at his feet and said, "For years I have been afflicted with a scourging hemorrhage. I have suffered many things from many physicians. I have spent all my substance, but none could cure me. Then I heard of you, and I thought, if I may but touch the hem of his garment, I shall certainly be made whole. And so I pressed forward with the crowd as it moved along until, standing near you, Master, I touched the border of your garment, and I was made whole. I know that I have been healed of my affliction." When Jesus heard this, he took the woman by the hand and, lifting her up, said, "Daughter, your faith has made you whole. Go in peace." It was her faith and not her touch that made her whole. And, you know, it goes on to say that she actually drew living energy out of him by her faith, by the power of her faith. She was able to draw healing energy from the Master. Isn't that the most amazing story? I love that.
And you know, the midwayers explain that further later in the book about these so-called unconscious miracles and what ingredients had to be in place before these could happen. But the number one on the list was strong living faith in the, by the part of a person seeking the miracle, and then close proximity, I think they mean physical proximity, to the Creator Son. And when the two get together, boom, you have one of these unconscious miracles.
Right.
So-called miracles.
Yeah. So-called miracles, but really, you know, and it tells us that through living faith, we could actually, you know, draw that healing energy out of the Master, you know, just by the power of living faith.
Yeah.
And what sort of personal miracles have you experienced? You know, instead
yeah,
of like,
right.
Yeah, well, just putting it out there to you
yeah,
and to our audience.
I've done enough speaking. Let's let other people speak.
Well, Lou, here's another caller, too, and I invite you to stay on if you like, or, you
thank
know,
you.
Whatever you want.
Paula, thank you.
You bet. Caller, you're with us on a Remembrance Birthday Brunch with Jesus the Master, and this is Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, Paula and Crystalline. This is Brother Dave.
Hey, Brother Dave.
Good afternoon, Brother Dave. It's afternoon where you live, isn't it? Or is it still morning?
Almost. Oh, it's three
yeah.
minutes to noon here, Central time.
High noon. So it's good to hear your voice. Thanks for calling. It's a pleasure.
Yes, good to hear you, too, and appreciate this show. What I'd like to share, I would like to read a half page from the Rancher book. This is one of my favorites. It's Jesus in Varancha form, his seventh Varancha appearance. And that's found on page 2034. And I won't read all the introduction. This is where Jesus returns in soul form to two brothers, Cleopas and Jacob, who are about three miles. Oh, it's beautiful. 3 miles from Jerusalem. And
okay,
and
before you begin,
yeah.
Bro Dave, I just want to throw out there real quick that when Bro Dave says Varancha form, for any of our listeners who may not know what he means by that, he said it's soul form. It's his soul form. So, okay, just wanted to say that.
Okay. So on page 2035, they're walking along, and Jesus says to them, "How slow you are to comprehend the truth. When you tell me that it is about the teachings and work of this man that you have your discussions, then may I enlighten you, since I am more than familiar with these teachings." Of course, this is Jesus in soul form teaching about the life, incarnate life mission of Jesus. Reading on. "Do you not remember that this Jesus always taught that his kingdom was not of this world? And that all men, being the sons of God, should find liberty and freedom and the spiritual joy of the fellowship of the brotherhood of loving service in this new kingdom of the truth of the Heavenly Father's love. Do you not recall how the Son of Man proclaimed the salvation of God for all men, ministering to the sick and afflicted, and setting free those who were bound by fear and enslaved by evil? Do you not know that this man of Nazareth told his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, be delivered up to his enemies, who had put him to death, and that he would arise on the third day? Now, I add here, the third day is a Jewish colloquial term, very common back in those days. It's not a literal 3 days. It just means soon or presently. Because Jesus was actually physically dead just 1.5 days, about, not three. Many Christians argue about that and try to, you know, figure ways to
make
get around
literal.
The problem that it was.
Yeah,
they take it literal, and then they say, well, it must have been Thursday he was crucified or something like that. So that's what that meant. Now, that's explained somewhere else in the Urantia book. All right, let's go on here. This gets very powerful. And Jesus says, have you not been told all of this? And have you never read in the scriptures concerning this day of salvation for Jew and Gentile, where it says that in him shall all the families of earth be blessed, that he will hear the cry of the needy and save the souls of the poor who seek him, that all nations shall call him blessed. That such a deliverer shall be as a shadow of a great rock in a weary land. Wow. That he will feed the flock like a true shepherd, gathering the lambs in his arms and tenderly carry them in his bosom. That he will open the eyes of the spiritually blind and bring the prisoners of despair out into full liberty and light. That all, who sit in darkness shall see the great light of eternal salvation. That he will bind up the brokenhearted, proclaim liberty to the captives of sin, and open up the prison to those who are enslaved by fear and bound by evil, that he will comfort those who mourn and bestow upon them the joy of salvation in the place of sorrow and heaviness, that he shall be the desire of all nations and the everlasting joy of those who seek righteousness, that this Son of truth and righteousness shall rise upon the world with healing light and saving power. Amen. Even that he will save his people from their sins, that he will really seek and save those who are lost, that he will not destroy the weak, but minister salvation to all who hunger and thirst for righteousness, that those who believe in him shall have eternal life, that he will pour out his Spirit upon all flesh, and that this Spirit of truth should be in each believer a well of water springing up into everlasting life. Did you not understand how great was the gospel of the kingdom which this man delivered to you? Do you not perceive how great a salvation has come upon you? Tremendous.
It's tremendous, you're right. And it's incredibly, incredibly meaningful to me. And I love the metaphors he gives, the shadow of a great rock in a weary land. You know, anybody who's ever, you know, well, in this crushing heat we've been experiencing, that metaphor really works
yeah.
well for me.
Indeed.
You know?
Good choice for a selection, Brother Dave. That was
Thank you.
I have one comment on this passage that always got to me. You know, Emmaus, where Cleopas and Jacob were from, was 7 miles west of Jerusalem. So they walked from Jerusalem back home, and when the master broke bread, they ran back to Jerusalem. Excuse me. this is 14 miles on foot. They were so excited. And here's another thing, because I thought it was supposed to be a secret that the apostles were hiding in the upper chamber. They go right to the upper chamber like, oh, everybody knows where the apostles are. But then, you know, that always, I never understood that, because I thought that they were in hiding in secret, but they knew exactly where to go, these two guys. So 14 miles on foot, and they knew where the secret chamber was.
They knew right where to go. That's a good. That's such a good insight, Lou. Thanks for sharing that. I had never thought about that, how far they had to run back.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Well, we have another caller.
It was only
caller,
three miles. It'd be 6 miles total.
The book says 7 miles west of Jerusalem. I'm looking right at it.
It does?
Yeah, honest to God. One.
I'm on page 2003-4. It says 3 miles, let's say on the Sunday afternoon, about 3 miles out of Jerusalem.
That's where
but
they
maybe
ran
they
into
walked
Jesus.
Further. I don't
That's
know.
That's where they ran into Jesus, and then they continued their walk home.
That was
a brisk
walk.
Yeah,
I think that's the other thing we have to remember is everybody walked back then, and they walked briskly. They probably walked with a purpose because they had to get where they were going in, you know, in daylight. Interesting thing to remember. Well, can we take another caller? I invite you guys to stay on if you like, and I will put 714 on. Area code 714, you're with us on our Remembrance Birthday Brunch.
Hi, sister. It's Dave Tucker.
Hey, Dave.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for
How are
calling
you?
Us.
Yeah, hello,
another,
brothers, too. I'm sorry.
Another in the order of Dave.
Yeah. 2 days make it right. That's what I'm told. Sorry, I know. It's cheese ball. It's a little too early on a Saturday for cheese humor. Hey, you know, every
it's
time.
It's never too early.
You know, I, every time, you know, I belong to I go to a great study group. I belong to Kermit Anderson's study group on Monday nights, and my brother, Michael McQueen and Mary and Kevin, everybody that comes is such a great group, and every year we have a member in supper, and we bring up, you know, instances that remind us of the Master, and every single time without fail, I'm gravitated towards paper 191, section 1, paragraph 2, and it's the appearance. It's the appearances, and it's actually the appearance to Peter. And it's pretty emotional. It just gets me every time I read it. And so I'll read it here. It says, Peter, the enemy desired to have you, but would not give you up. I knew it was not from the heart that you disowned me. Therefore, I forgive you even before you have asked. But now you must you cease to think about yourself and the troubles of the hour while you prepare to carry the good news of the gospel to those who sit in darkness. No longer should you be concerned with what you may obtain from the kingdom, but rather be exercised about what you can give to those who live in dire spiritual poverty. Gird yourself, Simon, for the battle of a new day. The struggle with spiritual darkness and the evil doubtings of the natural minds of men. Peter and the Maranta Jesus walked through the garden and talked of things past, present, and future for almost 5 minutes. Then the Master vanished from his gaze, saying, "Farewell, Peter, until I see you with your brethren." And it just reminds me of how passionate the Master is, and how deserving all of us are of mercy and forgiveness, and even what really gets me the most is that in the beginning, when Peter disowned the Master, he thought he was doing a good thing. He thought he had tricked them, and he thought he was obeying the Master because the Master had told him to not put himself into immediate danger, and he really perceived he was doing wrong. It wasn't until after he had committed that act that he had realized the gravity of the situation and what he had done, and that he had denied the Master, and the Master had told him about it before it happened. So I can only imagine the depression and the pain that he must have carried with him until he saw the Master, and then when he did see him, it's so beautiful. I can't even explain to you how it just resonates in my heart. And then to hear the Master say to him when I read it, you know, farewell until I see you with your brethren, it just brings me so much peace, you know, so much ease to know that, you know, I know the Master is going to see me too. And it's like he's talking to me because I feel like I'm Peter and I feel like I'm closest to Peter's character. And I'm so thankful for the Arantia book because of the personal touch it brings, the personal attention the Master gives, and the unique personalities that it shows in the Apostles. Like, I never had that in any other sacred writings, in anything in my life. I've never been able to form an opinion or a bond with the Apostles the way I have with the Arantia book. And it's changed my life, and I'm forever grateful. And I know that the Master is in my life, even when I'm away from him. I know he's calling. Like, I can hear him calling to me, even when I'm not there. So I wanted to share that share that with you guys.
That's a really meaningful one to me, too, Dave. I share the same experience with you in the Apostle Papers and also with Peter personally. I can really relate to a lot of his personality quirks.
Us extroverts really can relate to Peter.
Especially, one of the parts I especially relate to is being courageous when attacked from the front, but cowardice when attacked unexpectedly from the rear.
Oh, feet don't fail me now.
Oh, man.
Well, you brought me to tears, Dave.
me too. I wasn't expecting it. I'm sorry.
We love that about you.
Yeah.
We're all wet ones on this end.
Yeah, right. And, you know, Peter was impetuous. He was impetuous, and he was passionate. And he loved the Master so much. You know that the guilt that poor man carried with him for having denied the Master. I mean, he was crushed. He was crushed. And until Jesus, you know, Lou, thank you for posting on the board, tell my apostles and Peter. Yes, of course, because he knew that Peter, he knew how his apostle would internalize that guilt and how it would just eat him up. And he wanted to make a point. So, thank you. Kleenex all around. That was wonderful.
You know, I can't help but cry anytime the Master talks to Peter. Even like when Peter foolishly jumps out of the fishing boat to swim to the shore just to be the first one to see the Master. Like, I'm just bawling, you know. I'm like, oh, you're an idiot, Peter, but I love you. I would do it too, you know. I'd be like grabbing Peter's feet and pulling him backwards, you know, to try to get there even quicker.
Exactly. He is so impetuous. Lou, did you have something you wanted to say?
Yeah, I wanted this. You know, Dave, that's a great story, and you're right. We can all relate to being that guy who betrayed the Master. But the reason Peter left the room upstairs to go down to the garden is he thought his presence was preventing Jesus from visiting the apostles.
Right.
Well, he removes himself, and what happens? He gets a visitation. It's really pretty amazing. But the real tragic part of the story, he goes back upstairs and he's ecstatic with joy and nobody believes him. And Andrew makes a big point about saying, now my brother has seen things before that weren't there.
How can we trust you?
The water, right?
Yeah.
There's the irony.
There's a lot of dimensions to this story, and it's a great one.
Oh, absolutely.
Thanks for sharing it. It's a great one.
Yes. That's a great remembrance. And you know, when you know, as he said to his apostles in the Last Supper, he said in establishing the Last Supper and the remembrance, he said, "And as often as you do this, remember me in the life that I have lived among you." And the beautiful, the amazing thing that the Arantia book gives us is it gives us the fullness of that life. The glorious detail and beauty and richness and humanity of that life. And it's something like that that you can say, I know Peter. Peter's a brother. Peter's not just a saint. We all know that. Peter's human, and he's a brother. And the Master touched him in a very real and profound way, and he touches us all in that way. I love that about the Urantia book. It's priceless. It's the pearl of great price. And I'm sure it's what inspires us endlessly, all of us, to do whatever we can think of to share it. If only everybody could have him in this measure.
Oh, yeah.
If they could know him as we do, as Peter did, as you know, Matthew and Andrew and Nathaniel and James and John and Judas did, as Martha and Mary and, you know, your story reminded me of another vignette that I love so dearly, and it's because, you know, his interactions with women touch me. They touch me deeply. Lou, you mentioned his interactions with the two courtesans. Women have always been looked down upon on this planet for a long, long time, and we have a bigger hill to climb oftentimes. And so the story of him at Simon's house, and they were sitting, having a feast, and a woman came in and started weeping at his feet and wiping the tears of her eyes away with the hair of her head. And when she had finished anointing him, she continued weeping and kissing his feet. And when Simon saw all this, he said to himself, "This man, if he were a prophet, would have perceived who and what manner of woman this is who thus touches him, that she is a notorious sinner." And Jesus, knowing what was going on in Simon's mind, spoke up, "Simon, I have something which I would like to say to you." Simon answered, "Teacher, say on." Then said Jesus, "A certain wealthy moneylender who had two debtors, the one owed him 500 denarii and the other 50. Now when neither of them had wherewith to pay, he forgave them both. Which of them do you think, Simon, would love him most?" Simon answered, "He, I suppose, whom he forgave the most." And Jesus said, "You have rightly judged." And pointing to the woman, he continued, "Simon, take a good look at this woman. I entered your house as an invited guest, yet you gave me no water for my feet. This grateful woman has washed my feet with tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. You gave me no kiss of friendly greeting, but this woman, ever since she came in, has not ceased to kiss my feet. My head with oil you neglected to anoint, but she has anointed my feet with precious lotion. And what is the meaning of all this? Simply that her many sins have been forgiven, and this has led her to love much. But those who received little but little forgiveness sometimes love but little." And turning to the woman, he took her by the hand and lifting her up said, "You have indeed repented of your sins, and they are forgiven. Be not discouraged by the thoughtlessness and unkind attitude of your fellows. Go on in the joy and the liberty of the kingdom of heaven." You know, those stories are just throughout, obviously. The story of, you know, the other one, another one that just kills me, slays me every time I read it, is Mary, who loved him so dearly, Mary of Bethany. You know, oh, it's going to make me cry. I better not.
Yeah.
Say.
Oh, go for it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, she look how much she had to overcome, the courage she had to show to walk in front of all those men.
Yeah, indeed.
And anoint his feet with that precious oil that she'd been saving for his burial, because she absolutely took him at his word.
Right.
It's too much.
That is a very moving story.
Yeah.
And
that
you can
one
just,
kills
you can just visualize it so vividly, too.
Yeah, I know. It just, she, you know, she had the courage to go in and do what her heart was calling her to do, and I admire her so much for that. Unbelievably
so. You know,
mainstream
Christianity, I've heard some theologians refer to her as the nameless woman, when some want to confuse her with Mary of Bethany, who anointed Jesus' feet with the spikenard, later, and they know it's, and they concluded it wasn't Mary Magdalene, who had probably just as much gratitude in her soul for having been saved. But I've heard her called the Nameless Woman, because I don't think we ever get her name in the book.
Do you think that they can, they do confuse her with Mary Magdalene, do you think, most often?
I've heard that, yes. Because
yeah.
she has been forgiven much. It's easy to make that pleasure to Mary Magdalene.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, we have another caller, you guys, so I invite you to stay on if you want, and I'll put on another caller in our Remembrance with Jesus. Area code 719, you're with us on our Remembrance Birthday Brunch.
Hi, good morning. It's Kathy from Colorado Springs.
Hi, Kathy. Thanks for calling.
Sure. I tuned in a little bit late, so I didn't get to hear the whole story of the gentleman before, but it sounds like it was wonderful.
It was. it was his Jesus's visitation in the garden with Peter when Peter was so distraught and he left the upper chamber and went down and Jesus appeared to him.
Yes. Yes.
And so Dave Tucker made us all cry. He started a flood for me.
Well done, Dave.
Yeah, well
sorry,
done.
Not on purpose.
Happy tears, though.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Jesus makes a lot of us really emotional.
Mm-hmm. Well, he makes my heart swell, I can tell you. Just thinking of him. And when I get into that mode of remembering some of the things he did, my heart swells big time. But do you have something, Kathy, you want to share with us?
Crystalyn told me that it was about experiences with Jesus today.
Sure.
And
we're calling it a remembrance brunch, sharing a remembrance brunch with the Master in celebration of his birthday.
Yeah, it's coming right up. I believe there's something tomorrow, too, that I'm going to be coming to.
Yay, so, good. Me, too.
Yeah. Well, when Crystalyn said that, I thought of myself, I guess, and remembered back to when I first heard about Jesus. And as it happened, my father's father was a preacher in a Christian church. So from, I guess, the day I was born, I went to church every Sunday. And when I was really young, I was still in the nursery because I wasn't in Sunday school yet. And but they would play the sermon over an intercom with big speaker. So I can remember my first encounter with Jesus was they came over the intercom. There was my grandpa, and they had, since they do the traditional communion every week, and he said, well, anybody that, you know, believes in Jesus and that he's the Son of God, feel free to take communion. And I did, and I got in so much trouble. my grandmother was in there. I got in a lot of trouble for that. So I know that, you know, I've known Jesus since I was really small. But coming up through the church, I was always really disappointed because I would read, my favorite part was all the red letters in the Bible about Jesus. And then, you know, I would look around and, like everybody else, you know, oh, you people are all such hypocrites. You're not doing one thing that he said. And I left the church, and I was really rebellious. And I might be like one of those women that you were talking about. I had a lot to be forgiven, and I couldn't forgive myself. So after years and years and years, I'm 51 now, and it wasn't until January of this year that I met the real Jesus through the Urantia book. And it's just so incredibly freeing, and I was finally able to forgive myself, and after I forgave myself, then, you know, I really started talking to Jesus and getting to know him and realizing how much love there is, and there's no condemnation, and there's no shame, and there's no punishment, and so my life has turned around, wow, 180 degrees, and I've never been so happy and blessed, and just I want everybody to know what the real Jesus is like. So that's kind of where my focus has been, is trying to let as many people know in as many ways as I can how much Jesus and God loves us, you know, and they don't judge us and they don't hate us. And, you know, we're not in trouble. So that's my
Well, on that note, I just have to share this quote because it is really quite relevant. It's from Paper 140, Section 8, Paragraph 21. It's, Jesus had little to say about the social vices of his day. Seldom did he make reference to moral delinquency. He was a positive teacher of true virtue. He studiously avoided the negative method of imparting instruction. He refused to advertise evil. He was not even a moral reformer. He well knew, and so taught his apostles, that the sensual urges of mankind are not suppressed by either religious rebuke or legal prohibitions. Mm. His few denunciations were largely directed against pride, cruelty, oppression, and hypocrisy. Jesus did not vehemently denounce even the Pharisees, as did John. He knew many of the scribes and Pharisees were honest of heart. He understood their enslaving bondage to religious traditions. Jesus laid great emphasis on first making the tree good. He impressed the three that he valued the whole life, not just a certain few special virtues.
Mm. Beautiful.
Amen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Such a loving God. such a wonderful creator. I mean, it just blows my mind.
And he sent such a loving and amazing, forgiving, compassionate, kind and caring son as a revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how to think that we never got his life in full measure. And even what we did get of it has been somewhat lost in dogma and doctrine.
But that little we got was enough to begin to transform our world.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Thanks for letting me share.
Oh, thanks
beautiful.
For calling
and
in.
You know what? Thanks for, you're inspiring to me because you found the book in just, what, 8 months ago? You have completely dived in, and it changed your life. And you know the places you've gone. I mean, I know you went to Europe. You went to that conference. You came to Chicago. We all loved having you. Your enthusiasm, you know, the rapture that you feel as somebody who's just found the Urantia book. It's like when you watch your favorite movie for the with someone else who's seeing it for the first time. It's like reliving it for the first time yourself. And so it's really special. Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you.
Thank you for being so willing to share that with all of us.
Sure.
It's so meaningful.
We love you, Kathy.
Yeah.
I love you guys, too.
Welcome aboard the good ship Urantia, Kathy.
That's right. Safe haven.
Yeah.
Clear
yeah.
sailing.
So we have two other callers, and I'm so glad you guys are all calling in today to share your vignettes. And again, I invite you to stay on if you want. I will take this new caller, area code 514. I bet it's Diane.
I wonder who that is. Hi, everyone.
Happy Jesus birthday week, Diane.
Yeah. Oh, happy birthday. Jesus birthday. I wish it was every day. To me it is every day, so
it is.
Happy
and
Jesus.
I know you're getting really excited about Jesus' birthday for next year.
Oh yes. That is my special moment. I mean, ever since I was born, Jesus has been special in my life. But I really look forward to next summer in 2013 when the United Urantia family will meet on Jesus' birthday, for Jesus, with Jesus, at the spiritual headquarters at Yosemite Park, Grizzly Giant Tree, to go and sing him happy birthday and to do a prayer and worship service at the Grizzly Giant. Kristalyn and I had a wonderful talk last night, which brought me into tears because to me it's such a moving event. It will be a first on Urantia that 300 and more people will actually meet and gather right there at the spiritual headquarter on Urantia to recognize our Lord and Master Jesus Christ Michael on his birthday, August 21st at noon. And I showed Crystalline a bit of what to be expected, and I think it's beautiful, right, Crystalline?
Absolutely. Very inspiring.
Yes, we were very inspired last night, late and inspired, both of us. And so we are going to launch the registration, hopefully by Jesus' birthday on Tuesday. And we invite everyone to come and join us. What's beautiful, it's going to be in nature. Yosemite Park is absolutely superb. The place, Camp Wawona, where we're going to be staying, is a Christian camp, Seventh-day Adventist, so they're lovers of Jesus. And we have the whole camp to ourselves. Gar Jameson is wonderful. In Chicago, he confirmed that he will be doing a pre-retreat, just like a symphonic orchestra. We will all attune ourselves and harmonize ourselves before so that we can celebrate Jesus' birthday as a family, a united family on earth, in the knowledge of the fifth epochal revelation, the Urantia book. And that's what I meant to say, you know, that it will be the first time that in the consciousness, in the knowledge of the Urantia book, we gather on Jesus' birthday there at the spiritual headquarters in the presence, as the theme says, celebrating Jesus' family in the presence of angels. So
beautiful. And can you share something right now with us that you're experiencing with Jesus in this moment for in honor of his birthday coming up?
Well, to me, what I experience is when I was at the study group, there's many things, but there's one that come in my mind right now, and it's when I was at the fellowship summer study group, summer study session at the Chicago conference. I think it was in 2008. I was at the bookstore and at Techni Tower, and I was going through the books, and then I found this book on Mother Teresa. And it was really beautiful and exceptional because it was written by, it had just come out just a few months, 2-3 months before. And it was written by a priest who lived with her for many years and was privy to many confidences and many things that Mother Teresa had not revealed to the world. And we know what a great unconditional servant of Jesus she was. And so in the book, at one moment, he wrote that she told him that on September 10th, 1946, because I don't know if you knew, but in all the monasteries that Mother Teresa started around the world, they all had a saying at the door entrance outside. Just as people arrive at the monastery, they all see a saying, and he was explaining that some people were wondering why was that saying, and it was Mother Teresa that had been told by Jesus. And then on the 10th of September, he revealed to her, he actually spoke to her and said, "They don't know me, so they don't want me." And that really, really touched me because it brought me back to the Urantia book where it says that if you don't know people, you won't learn to love people. You have to, I don't remember the quote exactly, I'm sure Paula, you know what I'm talking about. You could probably recite it by heart.
I don't know.
You know, but you have to get to have to know people to get to love people and to say, I know you better. So and as you know someone better and closer, you know, very often you hear of someone and you get in the family and someone says, yeah, so and so and so, and they talk negatively about the person. And then one day you have a family gathering, you get to have a talk with that so-called person, and after the person finishes, you go, my God, am I ever glad I got to know you personally, because, well, it's not really what I have been told about you, but what a wonderful person you are. And then you start to love the person. And
right.
So when I read that, it's almost like my devotion has been to help people to know Jesus. And I remember saying to Jesus, well, if that's what you said to Mother Teresa, then my wish is that I want the world to get to know you so they can want you. And that's what the Urantia book does. They make us discover a Jesus never before seen or heard of or described. Such a story of love. You cannot stop crying. I mean, so often I say, geez, I love you, Jesus. Do you ever make me cry? It's so moving, just like you just did a few minutes ago, Paula. It's so moving. It's so, you become enamored by Jesus. I mean, you're totally in love with Jesus. You just don't know about Jesus. You are in love with Jesus. And just like when you're in love with a child, with a husband, with a mate, and they make you cry so much so, because you love them, Jesus does that to people when we discover him. So my special something has become a daily pilgrimage to help people to know Jesus so they can want Jesus and to find out that he's not just the Jesus that they may have known or the little partial description they had, but he's this extraordinary, out of the ordinary human being. And the Urantia book says it. He is not only Michael, because he has resurrected and he has been made sovereign of his local universe, but he remains Jesus Christ Michael, the human Jesus as he ever was. He still is right here, right now. And so he's so real. He's not just Jesus that lived 2,000 years ago and died. He's Jesus here and now, plus the sovereign of this local universe. So it's a total love affair.
It is a total love affair. And Gumshoe reminded us on the board that Jesus is here and now. And so I told him, I said, Diane must have read your mind, because that was the point that you had to share with us.
He's totally
and we know
here
that you,
and now.
He is always with us, every moment. And there's a couple
Absolutely.
More callers, so again, I invite you all to stay on if you like, and let's see if we can get in the last 24 minutes or so, a couple more who want to share an experience with Jesus with us. So hang in here.
So
caller, you're with
everyone.
Us. Goodbye, Diane. Thank you for reminding us about that.
Yes, and
Love
bravo
you.
For your program.
Thank you, darling.
Thank
Bye,
you.
Bye, Crystalline.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Caller, you're with us on the Remembrance Birthday Brunch.
Hello.
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 Justin, can you hear me?
Hi, Justin. Yes, of course.
Hi.
Good to have you on the show.
Thanks for calling in.
Oh,
my pleasure. My pleasure. Of course, whenever I can. Believe it.
You've been on hold for a while, so I appreciate it. Thank you.
All the way from Japan.
Yeah. Okay. So then you know that this is the Justin from Japan. There's a very
is,
prominent.
I recognize your voice.
Excellent. Wow. It's a wonderful thing. But not to take up too much of your time, but I program and there have been so many emotional movements that I've had I almost felt like, well, this is good. I feel like I'm coming in touch. It's my, what do they say, my feminine side. What do they call that? I guess that's what you're saying. I'm getting in touch with that part of me that feels and intuitively knows. And that's a wonderful expression of what Jesus' life was. But then I said, well, what about, you know, for guys that like to go to see superhero movies, you know, and Superman, and they want to see Indiana Jones. And you know, and so while you, I've heard so many great, I would say great portrayals of Jesus' life that revealed that touching sentimental aspect to his love. I figured that just to add to that, not that I could possibly say that it could compete with that, but that to add to that, I thought there might be a selection that might also speak to his power. And So what I've chosen, it was the Nazareth rejection.
Oh, wow, great.
Oh, yeah.
So if you don't mind, in the interest of time, so I it would take me longer to try to explain what happened in my own words than to just read it. I figured that I would give it a read and let you know that this is something that has moved me greatly, and I would challenge you or anyone else who's listening, perhaps you can tell me why. but this is, it moves me greatly, and I really have not figured out exactly why. I haven't put it into words yet. I've never really had the opportunity to do that. But this is the selection that has moved me greatly. And it begins with, Jesus found himself surrounded in a synagogue by a great throng of his enemies and a sprinkling of his own followers. And in reply to their rude questions and their sinister banterings, he half-humorously remarked, "Yes, I am Joseph's son. I'm the carpenter. And I'm not surprised that you remind me of the proverb, physician, heal yourself, and that you challenge me to do in Nazareth what you have heard I did in Capernaum. But I call you to witness that even the scriptures declare that a prophet is not without honor save in his own country and among his own people." But they jostled him, and pointing accusing fingers at him, said, "You think you are better than the people of Nazareth? You moved away from us, but your brother is a common workman, and your sisters still live among us. We know your mother, Mary. Where are they today? We hear big things about you, but we notice that you do wonders when you do no wonders when you come back." Jesus answered them, "I love the people who dwell in the city where I grew up, but I would rejoice to see all enter the kingdom of heaven. But the doing of the works of God is not for me to determine. The transformations of grace are wrought in response to the living faith of those who are the beneficiaries." Now, Jesus would have good-naturedly managed the crowd and effectively disarmed even his violent enemies had it not been for the tactical blunder of one of his own apostles, Simon, who, with the help of Nahor, one of the younger evangelists, had meanwhile gathered together a group of Jesus' friends among the crowd and, assuming a belligerent attitude, had served a notice upon the enemies of the master to go hence. Jesus had long taught the apostles that a soft answer turns away wrath, but his followers were not accustomed to seeing their beloved teacher, whom they so willingly called master, treated with such discourtesy and disdain. It was too much for them, and they found themselves giving expression to passionate and vehement resentment, all of which only tended to arouse the mob spirit in the ungodly and uncouth assembly. And so, under the leadership of hirelings, these ruffians laid hold on Jesus and rushed him out of the synagogue to the brow of a nearby precipitous hill, where they were minded to shove him over the edge to his death below. But just as they were about to push him over the edge of the cliff, Jesus turned suddenly upon his captors and, facing them, quietly folded his arms. He said nothing. But his friends were more than astonished when, as he started to walk forward, the mob parted and permitted him to pass unmolested. I'll stop there.
Wow.
Now that's Superman to me.
That
serious,
is Superman.
I'm being very serious. That's Superman. That's Iron Man. That's all of them wrapped up in one. That's the superhero right there.
And a couple of the things that Lou shared too, also were like that too. You know, that when he cleared the temple and you know his last temple discourse as well, and you know, that is the Superman. That's the mighty master. And I think you're right, you're absolutely right, in the symmetry of his personality, the softness of his gentle side, the strength of his courage. It's just astonishing to me. And, you know,
well,
you just want to kind of fall down. It's so beautiful.
Yeah,
doing it.
That's it. And I think that's what he did. It's the notion that your very kindness, your gentleness can be the strength.
Right.
If you could just turn around, say nothing, and cross your arms, and somehow there is both gentleness and yet authority in that gesture. That would cause people to relent.
I'm going to offer something here. Justin,
sure,
good choice of passages, Justin. This was discussed at length at a gathering I was at several years ago, and people wanted to know what really happened here. How was Jesus able to dissuade a bunch of uncouth ruffians from throwing him off a cliff? And because he obviously didn't change their minds. These were people bent on mischief. They were not open to his words or his love or anything. And someone offered this, and I just think it's an interesting theory, that when he turned around and folded his arms, this is a practical explanation rather than just the charm of his personality. When he turned around and folded his arms, he projected his chi to the point where the crowd parted. They were literally thrown out of the way, and he was able to walk by. And someone offered that as an explanation, and I thought it was an interesting explanation.
Hmm. His chi?
Yes,
wow.
You know, that's what I'm talking about. There you go. Superman.
Superman.
Okay, some people say he shot lasers out of his eyes. Well, he projected his chi, but what I'm saying, he had that power, and it was a spiritual power. That's what that, no matter how you explain it, no matter what you could, I think there are some people I've heard explain it as saying that he had a psychic connection with these people, that he was able to invoke that psychic connection, that he always had this power over people but chose not to use it. And in this moment, he chose that he would use it simply because he had to continue his mission.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter how you explain it. The interesting thing about it is that he had this power. It doesn't matter how we define the power, but he had this power. And the interesting thing is how he applied it, when he applied it, and where he applied it.
Well, and you know, that begs to me another story, of course, when he's standing in the Garden of Gethsemane and they come to arrest him, and Peter goes to draw his sword, and he turns to Peter and he says, "Put up your sword. Don't you realize that even now there are legions of angels who would come to deliver me from the hands of these few men?"
Yeah.
And that, again, speaks to his power. He literally he's the commander of legions of angels. And, of course, because we don't see them, we give no credence to their power. But mistake not, they are there. They are real. They are waiting for his word to act. And they will act at a moment's notice, in a nanosecond, if he gives them that word. And that's power. That's spiritual power that this world doesn't even comprehend, doesn't even begin to comprehend. But, you know, oftentimes I've seen Urantia book readers fall into the same willingness to defend the revelation by the sword, essentially, when even now legions of angels are guarding it, protecting it. And it has no less protection. The Urantia book has no less protection than Jesus had, and at his command. So, you know, we fool ourselves to think that we're in control of what's going on. Down here, we're not. And nothing happens except by the express desire of the Heavenly Father. The Most Highs do rule in the kingdoms of men. And they intervene if they have to. And there's power in that.
And Jesus, remember, too, he says the teachings of Jesus constitute a religion of valor, courage, and heroism.
Right.
And this is just why he chose as his personal representative 12 commonplace men, the majority of whom were rugged, virile, and manly fishermen. And later on in that same, I guess it's the next paper after that, he was simple, manly, honest, and fearless, with all of his physical and intellectual influence manifest in the Master's presence. There were also those spiritual charms of being which have become associated with his personality: patience, tenderness, meekness, gentleness, and humility.
Beautiful.
Those were those are listed as part of the most powerful aspects of his personality.
Yes, I would love for that to be something that little boys were taught that's how Superman is.
Great.
Real power. There's a part in Paper 140, Section 5, 16, where, you know, he's talking about the, you know, the happy are they who mourn quote. And it says, but of course Jesus did not refer to outward or ostentatious mourning. He alluded to an emotional attitude of tenderness. It is a great error to teach boys and young men that it is unmanly to show tenderness or otherwise to give evidence of emotional feeling or physical suffering. Sympathy is a worthy attribute of the male as well as the female. It is not necessary to be callous in order to be manly. This is the wrong way to create courageous men. The world's great men have not been afraid to mourn. Moses, the mourner, was a greater man than either Samson or Goliath. Moses was a superb leader, but he was also a man of meekness. Being sensitive and responsive to human need creates genuine and lasting happiness, while such kindly attitudes safeguard the soul from the destructive influences of anger, hate, and suspicion. Isn't that a great quote?
Oh my, yes.
That's a perfect quote.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I want to say to area code 719 who was waiting online, oh, I was just seconds away from answering your call. So if you want to call back, please do. I'm sorry that I didn't get right to you.
Call back.
Yeah, come on, George, call us back. We weren't trying to ignore you. We're just trying to give everybody an ample opportunity to flesh out their idea. And
but we're down to the last 10 minutes, so.
Well, we are. And someone on the board just mentioned the acme of religious living. And we can actually end with that if our area code 719, maybe George doesn't give us a call back. Justin, I invite you to read that if you'd like to. Or Lou,
okay.
Either one. You know where it is? It's paper 100, section 7.
Hold on one moment. Let me...
What's one of the words from, the key words from the quote?
The acme. Acme is, you know, acme of religious living.
Oh, okay. So I'll do the high-tech thing and search it. Is that...
Sure.
It's in paper 100, section 7.
And here's our caller 719 again, so we'll save that for the very last. Get it all queued up there, Justin. And 719, thanks for calling back.
Hello? You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Is this okay? It's live. I heard that before,
yeah.
But I wasn't sure if it was going through. Okay. Cool. This is George.
Hi, George.
Hi.
Sorry
thanks
we
for
didn't
calling
get
in
soon enough. Yeah, thanks for calling back.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I have been doing a lot of talking and discussing as usual with Buck Weimer, you know, my good buddy.
Our
and,
dear friend.
Yes, a longtime dear friend. And we have been doing the William Sadler Jr. Introductions to the Master Universe and that whole text that he did.
Wow.
And we have been studying some interesting things lately about as time ends and the pattern of creation gets out beyond the fourth outer space levels that are supposed to be 70,000 super universes, we're stretching our brain.
Yeah.
it's the pattern that the Creator Son lays down, you know, in the creation of the local local universes that make up the super universes, that eventually will be 70,000 of them. That blows my mind.
Oh, man.
I'm just trying to picture the pattern.
Yeah.
You know,
and our Master is such a beautiful, exquisite example of the pattern of the Universal Father.
Gotta be. I agree, 100%. And that's why we're kind of excited, because they were talking about how Jesus revealed the Father to us. We as Agon Donters, after we're established in our post-Havona career out in the outer space levels will be doing the same thing that Jesus did for us here.
Right. Oh, isn't that amazing to think about?
We
get to model for those classes of future ages.
Right.
The love of God and the love of our Master.
Right. On a bigger, we don't even know what it looks like. I mean, we've got John Byron's universe pictures to help us, you know, conceptualize what it looks like.
Right.
Old Chick Montgomery's when he first started it way back. But this, you know, the whole expansion and dynamicism of his personality, his character, his belief, his faith, his knowledge, his wisdom, his experience. And that's what we're helping him achieve, is his experience, so that he can go on to greater things, as we will go on to greater things.
So sublime. So, and with that, Justin, we have Justin all queued up, ready to read The Acme of Religious Living, and we'll end the show with that.
Cool. Thank you so much.
God bless. Thank you, George.
Oh. Happy Jesus' birthday, George.
Yeah.
Thank you,
happy
you too.
Jesus' birthday,
love
everyone.
Candles.
Yeah. And light them again.
In more ways than one.
I would also say, you know, George, it's not only that we will be doing what Jesus did, but we'll actually be competent to do it because of what Jesus did, which is an extraordinary thing as well, or we'll have done even by then. But going on to the acme of religious living, although the average mortal of Urantia cannot hope to attain the high perfection of character which Jesus of Nazareth acquired while sojourning in the flesh, it is altogether possible for every mortal believer to develop a strong and unified personality along the perfected lines of the Jesus personality. The unique feature of the Master's personality was not so much its perfection as its symmetry, its exquisite and balanced unification. The most effective representation of Jesus consists in following the example of the one who said, as he gestured toward the Master standing before his accusers, "Behold the man." The unfailing kindness of Jesus touched the hearts of men. But this stalwart strength of character amazed his followers. He was truly sincere. There was nothing of the hypocrite in him. He was free from affectation. He was always so refreshingly genuine. He never stooped to pretense, and he never resorted to shamming. He lived the truth, even as he taught it. He was the truth. He was constrained to proclaim saving truth to his generation, even though such sincerity sometimes caused pain. He was unquestioningly loyal to all truth. But the Master was so reasonable, so approachable. He was so practical in all his ministry, while all his plans were characterized by such sanctified common sense. He was so free from all freakish, erratic, and eccentric tendencies. He was never capricious, whimsical, or hysterical. In all his teaching and everything he did, there was always an exquisite discrimination associated with an extraordinary sense of propriety. The Son of God was always a well-poised personality. Even his enemies maintained a wholesome respect for him. They even feared his presence. Jesus was unafraid. He was surcharged with divine enthusiasm, but he never became fanatical. He was emotionally active, but never flighty. He was imaginative, but always practical. He frankly faced the realities of life, but he was never dull or prosaic. He was courageous, but never reckless, prudent, but never cowardly. He was sympathetic, but not sentimental. Unique, but not eccentric. He was pious, but not sanctimonious. He was so well poised because he was so perfectly unified. Jesus' originality was unstifled. He was not bound by tradition or handicapped by enslavement to narrow conventionality. He spoke with undoubted confidence and taught with absolute authority. But his superb originality did not cause him to overlook the gems of truth in the teachings of his predecessors and contemporaries. And the most original of his teachings was the emphasis of love and mercy in the place of fear and sacrifice. Of Jesus, it was truly said, he trusted God. As a man among men, he most sublimely trusted the Father in heaven. He trusted his Father as a little child trusts his earthly parents. His faith was perfect but never presumptuous. No matter how cruel nature might appear to be, he or how indifferent to man's welfare on earth, Jesus never faltered in his faith. He was immune to disappointment and impervious to persecution. He was untouched by failure. Do we have time to go on?
We probably don't, but man, that is
no,
so
we're
beautiful.
Really down to the last few seconds, actually.
And we recommend that, paper 100, section 7. Study it, look up the meanings of the words. It's pretty awesome.
The really interesting thing about that paper is it occurs before the life of Christ. Paper 100, and the life of Christ begins at the paper 120. So.
Right. It's a great precursor to
what
you're about.
Oh, yeah, this is
about
Melchizedek talking about him. Yeah.
Right.
Well, on that note, folks.
This is the highest personality talking about him, man. It's amazing.
Well, God bless you all for being with us to enjoy this birthday celebration brunch, this remembrance brunch. And as we go off the air, join us again next week. And thanks so much to all of you for calling in. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Lou. Thanks for hanging in here with us the whole time. And Justin, so appreciate you calling from Japan.
Great
and
show.
George and Kathy and everybody, thanks for sharing Jesus. Dave Tucker, thanks for making us cry. We really love it. And have a great celebration tomorrow, wherever you are, or on the 21st, and in the next week, in remembrance of our Lord and Master Jesus.
Amen.
Amen. And bye for
Thank
now.
Thank you. Bye for now, folks.
Bye for now.
Till next time.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.